News Talk Breakfast with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
In association with AIR.
On News Talk.
As a child of an alcoholic father, Sarah Drage is now passionate about the need for greater support to be offered for those in their position. Sarah is a mental health advocate, co-host of the Children of Alcoholics, or COA, podcast, and ambassador for the National Association for Children of Alcoholics in the UK. She joins us now. Sarah, thanks so much for talking to us this morning. Can you start by telling us your story and the story of your dad, Steve's addiction?
Oh, hi, Shane. Thank you so much for having me. My dad, oh God, where do I start? My dad was such a wonderful, kind, loving, sensitive man. He really was, but he had so many demons, anxiety, depression, had experienced some trauma, and as a coping mechanism, he used alcohol to cope. And I think you probably agree with me when I say that for men especially, it's really difficult for them to express their emotions in a world that is so, the society suppresses men's emotions, doesn't necessarily teach men how to open up and speak out, and stigmatizes it. So my dad used to tell me that he drank to forget. And I didn't really understand it at the time growing up with that. He always used to say, when I'd ask him, why are you doing this? Why are you putting us through this? And his response was always, I drink to forget. If I didn't drink, then I'd be dead. Now as an adult, those words speak really loud to me. I really kind of look back with so much empathy and so much love and just sadness around that.
Because that's tragic, isn't it, to have somebody say that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But at the time, you're so, as that child of an alcoholic growing up in that environment, you don't understand why they're doing it. On the outside, it looks really simple. Like all of this stress, all of these problems would stop if you just stopped drinking. But for my dad, unfortunately, he was physically dependent on alcohol, which meant that he needed it like we need water to survive. If he would have stopped drinking, then he would have gone into withdrawal and died sooner.
I was very taken by something you said in the newspaper interview. You said you always put yourself under huge pressure to fix your dad, to rescue him, to cure him.
Yes, I did. I did.
That's a lot to take on, isn't it, for a child?
Yeah, as the eldest daughter, I felt a huge responsibility. I always had this unwavering feeling that I could save him, that I could help him, that I could fix him and bring the family back together, unite us all back together and live happily ever after. Yeah. But that just absolutely was not the case at all. And you do, as that child, and especially as an adult child, you do feel that responsibility. You want to help that parent, you want to support them. But it's such, and now I know as an adult that can't happen. I could not have saved my dad. My dad needed to do that and want that for himself. But at the time growing up around that, you believe that you can help them with that. But, you know, growing up with an alcoholic parent, it's unpredictable, it's heartbreaking, and it's a frightening environment. You're watching somebody that you know what they're like without the drink. You know who they are as a person, and then when they're drinking, they're completely different. They're a different personality. You don't know what you're coming home to every day. The environment's unpredictable. You don't know what mood they're in. So you develop this sense of overwhelming anxiety, and you love them and you hate them at the same time. One moment you want to fix them, you want to save them, you want to help them, and the next you absolutely hate and resent them.
I'm sure, yeah. You did get 16 months close to the end of your dad's life where he was sober, and you say you got your dad back for that period.
I did, yes. And those 16 months, they were wonderful. But looking back, my dad would be now what we would describe as a dry drunk. He was really white knuckling. He had no support or didn't access any support resources once you've gotten sober. So on the outside, we would see, oh, we've got a dad back. You know, that tone of voice is back to normal. His face doesn't look bloated, red and flushed anymore. We can understand what he's saying. He's stringing a sentence together. He's not slurring his speech. It's nice to be around him. But beneath that surface, he was really struggling. And hiding it.
He did then, when your grandfather and his dad died, he relapsed.
Yes, he didn't have those tools, those coping mechanisms. And as I was saying at the beginning of the conversation, society heavily stigmatizes men for opening up and expressing their emotions. So my dad went back to the only coping mechanism he knew, which was drinking. And that was to suppress and numb those feelings.
And you blamed yourself at the time when that happened. Now, obviously, you know now it wasn't your fault, but at the time, you did blame yourself for that.
I did, yes.
That's a huge responsibility again to take on, isn't it?
I thought I killed him. And I know that's really irrational, but at the time, walking into the room where he'd relapsed and he started drinking again, and I knew again, I thought, oh God, okay, here we go. Like, we'd been through this on so many occasions. And this was his longest stint of sobriety. So I just assumed, okay, he's relapsed again. We'll get him detoxed. We'll get him sober. And then we'll start the process all over again. It was always a case of, I'll stop Monday. And we had so many Mondays. So when he'd relapsed this time, it was very different. He was showing signs, now that I know, are signs of liver failure. My dad genuinely thought that he could get over it himself. And he said to me when I begged him to go to hospital, he said that he didn't want to waste his doctor's time. He could get out of it himself. And he'd caused it himself. He'd done it to himself. So he didn't deserve medical attention. That was his attitude around it. And I didn't call an ambulance. And 3 days later, he died. So that was a huge, huge regret on my part at the time. And I say that at the time because I think I put so much blame and took so much responsibility for that. But I was also a young woman. I was 27. I didn't know what we were dealing with. We were alone. We were unsupported. We didn't have the resources. We didn't know where to go. I didn't know how to help him. I now know that I couldn't. It wasn't my responsibility. I didn't cause it. I couldn't cure it. I couldn't fix it. But at the time, you know, you really take that responsibility on as that eldest child, especially to protect that adult. The roles reversed. I felt like I needed to protect him.
Oh, that's so difficult, Sarah. It really is. You learned, obviously, and now you understand that wasn't the case, that it wasn't your responsibility, that there was nothing you could have done. Did that take a long time for that to happen?
It did, yes. You know, when he died, because of the stigma attached to alcohol addiction, it was easier for me to tell everybody that he died from a heart attack. And it was a few years after he died that I started campaigning around mental health. And then I found NACOA, the National Association for Children of Alcoholics. And I realized that I wasn't alone. And you spend so long keeping this dirty secret. That's how I describe it to people. It's deemed as this dirty secret. We don't tell anybody about it. We don't talk about it. And you believe that you're alone. You believe that all of these things that you're experiencing and that you're going through living with an alcoholic parent are ours alone, and nobody else would understand it. And then all of a sudden I found NACOA and I found other people and I found Amy, the co-host, my co-host of the COA podcast, who'd also had a dad called Steve who died from his alcohol addiction.
Right.
And suddenly we're having this conversation and there's so many moments where we're going, me too. I felt like that. And, you know, we're strangers having this 2-hour conversation.
That must
about
be
how
fantastic to be able to find someone who had so much in common, who went through the same thing. That must be a great comfort, or must have been a great comfort.
Yeah, it was really bittersweet. Like, obviously, it's not
It's
not nice to bond over something like that. But at the same time, yeah, it was comforting. It was a relief as well to know that I weren't alone. I wasn't being dramatic. I wasn't imagining how bad all of this was. And I know that's ridiculous because he died from it. So I know I wasn't imagining it. But because you've been conditioned to believe that it's not a problem, we keep it quiet, we don't talk about it. You kind of do. You hide this secret and you stay silent. And then all of a sudden, it's quite liberating not being silent anymore, not keeping that secret, talking about it, sharing it out loud and talking to people that have also been through it. And knowing that just by being vulnerable and opening up and talking about your experience, that it kind of triggers a domino effect where other people join in.
It does.
And you get so many people then that come back and say, me too.
I can imagine.
Me too.
And you've spoken this morning with extraordinary eloquence about your own story and extraordinary honesty. What do you hope to achieve? What do you hope society achieves? Where do we need to go, in your view?
I think there's a lot of changes that need to be made, especially around the alcohol industry taking responsibility for the dangers of it and for the repercussions of addiction on family members. But I think the first step, and I'm a huge advocate for this, I think the first step is to destigmatize and to have open, honest conversations, to feel comfortable to be vulnerable and to talk about things like this. It's not a nice subject to talk about. It's not an easy subject to talk about.
And it's an important subject to talk about, isn't it?
It absolutely is. You know, 1 in 5 children that we know of are affected by a parent's drinking. And then there's adults, 1 in 3 adults are affected by a loved one's drinking. And we hide in secrecy, we hide in shame, we hide in silence. And that affects us as well as the loved ones. We keep those secrets. We try to protect our loved ones. We desperately don't want people around us finding out, and we don't want to embarrass them or humiliate them because of the stigma. So I think the first step is removing that stigma, empowering people to be vulnerable, to open up and talk about these things, because they're happening everywhere, especially in a society that suppresses emotions. You know, we talk a lot about it's okay to talk, it's okay to open up, but is it? When we really do, what are we met with? Are we met with support? Are we met with compassion? Or are we met with judgment and shame? And I think it's removing that judgment and shame and having that empowerment to say, I need help, I need support.
And is that support and help there for those people who are able to do that?
It is, but there could be more. And there definitely is with the likes of NACOA, the National Association for Children of Alcoholics. There's a 24-hour helpline available for people that are affected by a loved one's drinking. There are a lot of charities out there that offer support for people affected by alcohol dependency or any addiction for that matter. But there isn't necessarily a huge amount of government funding that's targeted towards people that are affected by addiction. That could be better, in my opinion. And I think that needs to change. I think it's the root cause of a lot of problems and a lot of issues. I think there needs to be more awareness around signposting as well. You know, it's really difficult to get a GP appointment. It's really hard to pluck up the courage to actually talk to somebody and ask for help and admit that you need that support. So when you do that, having that support readily available and getting people into the right support pathways as quickly as possible would be a really good way to prevent people from reaching that crisis point. But unfortunately, it's not always there. It's not that easy for people to access that support without attending expensive rehab facilities. So I think there needs to be a lot more investment put into that, and not just solely dependent on charitable organisations.
Okay. Sarah, thank you so much for talking to us this morning. We really appreciate your honesty and your eloquence and your courage in speaking to us. Keep up with the good work. Sarah Drage, thank you so much for talking to News Talk Breakfast this morning.
News Talk Breakfast with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
In association with AIR.
Weekday mornings at 7 on News Talk.